On June 30th, 1905, a young patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland, submitted a paper entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, submitted it to a leading German physics journal. That paper introduced the ideas that would become known as the special theory of relativity. It was one of five papers that Einstein would submit that miracle year, ideas that would fundamentally change the way people thought about the universe and usher in a new era of physics. So for the rest of this hour, we're going to talk about that special relativity paper, how it solved some of the biggest problems in physics, and what it was about that struggling patent clerk that made him the greatest physicist of his era, perhaps of all time. If you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. David Kaiser is an associate professor of the history of science and a lecturer in physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT in Cambridge. He joins us today by phone. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kaiser.
Thanks very much, Ira.
Okay, let's set the scene for us. What were the big problems 100 years ago that physicists were trying to solve?
Yeah, you know, it's easy for us to lose track today, what we might take for granted today. But just over 100 years ago, there were lots of questions on the table that might surprise us that they were still even questions. One of the hottest topics that exercised people like Einstein and got them really excited was the science of electrodynamics, which is really the study of how electric charges and magnets behave, how the electric and magnetic fields that they generate and interact with behave. And this whole area had gotten a huge jolt, so to speak, in the 1860s, just about 15 years before Einstein was born, by the work of the Scottish mathematical physicist James Clerk Maxwell, who was then working at Cambridge, England. And Maxwell had shown that light itself was nothing other than a wave of electric and magnetic fields. So in the 1860s, Maxwell had subsumed the entire subject of optics into this larger area of electrodynamics. People like Einstein, Einstein was born in 1879, so just a few years after these quite big developments, the really ambitious ones wanted to study this new electrodynamics, this new area of electric and magnetic behavior. In fact, Einstein got very frustrated. He was always a very independent-minded kid, and as a college student, he would frequently cut his classes so he could stay at home or more often go to a local cafe and read up on his own about things like the Maxwell electrodynamics and the latest developments in that field. He got his hands on a few of the newest German language textbooks in the area, and he delighted in self-study. So that was one topic that he really threw himself into as a young student.
Mm-hmm. And so what did he decide he's going to try to figure out how light works?
That's right. And so, in fact, even at the age of 16, so long before he was even a university student, he'd had a lot of sort of almost daydreams or thought experiments about how light behaves, and he had puzzles about it. Mm. So one of them that he recounted years later, and he said had really stuck in his mind starting at a very young age, was what would happen if he could ride along a light wave, almost like a surfer on an ocean wave. And he was trying to figure out, using what he learned about electrodynamics, about optics, and the new science from Maxwell and Hertz and others, what would he see? So if he were chasing a light wave, he would see it still moving ahead of him, and it would look wave-like. But what if he actually caught up with it? What if he moved as quickly as the wave itself had moved, at the speed of light? Then he started to realize that what he should see as he looked to his left or his right would be a stationary wave. There would be sort of bumps and troughs, but they would stand still. They wouldn't be moving over time, as far as he was concerned, riding with them. And that was very puzzling to him, because he realized there was no such exact solution for how light should behave according to Maxwell's very exciting equations. So Maxwell said light should always be a wave, which meant it should, in some sense, always be traveling. It should always be moving. It should never be static or standing still. So Einstein, from the age of 16, and then as he got more and more skills from reading these textbooks, realized there's something funny going on here about light travel, about electrodynamics, and this stuck with him for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And so he then said, well, if light should be moving, it should have a constant speed, and I'll use that as a measuring stick for the rest of my measurements of physics?
Exactly right. So that's what he finally gets to by 1905. Mm-hmm. He didn't quite have that at the age of 16, but right. By the age of 26, in fact, he elevates that very notion to a starting postulate in his famous paper, which was entitled On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. The paper is a sort of unusual, funny-looking paper, even by its own standards of its day, let alone for modern readers. And it sets out by stating two postulates. He doesn't argue for their truth. He doesn't say, I've conducted 75 experiments and this is what they look like on average. He says, let me just start with these. Let me deduce, posit these, and deduce what should happen from them. And that was one of his initial starting points.
And what did the paper say? What were the concepts that came out of that paper?
Well, there were many, and some of the words might be familiar, mm-hmm. but things like time dilation, length contraction, the relativity of simultaneity, those are all sort of fancy words.
Right.
But what they basically come down to, as Einstein showed really in about three or four pages, the opening few paragraphs of this famous paper, was that once we reorient how we think about space and time and about measurement, then a lot of these sort of puzzles start to melt away. And so what he said was, for example, if we are moving relative to each other, let's say Einstein's sitting on a train that's moving unusually fast, very close to the speed of light, and that you or I are sitting still on this train station platform. So we see each other in relative motion. If we then start making measurements of things like the length of a meter stick or the time it takes for a clock to tick, it's sort of second hand, then we'll actually start disagreeing on the results of those measurements. Even if we had perfectly identical measuring rods, you know, yardsticks
right.
beforehand, even if we had exactly identical clocks before we started moving with respect to each other, we'd measure the quantities in each other's reference frame to be different from those we measure in our own.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that Einstein got it wrong, Einstein would say that I got it wrong, and we'd disagree by the exact same amount.
Mm-hmm. Because you would see the other person's measuring units change. You'd see the other person's yardstick might be change in size.
That's right.
Time
and
would change, but the light would stay constant.
That's right. That's right. And so what Einstein started realizing is if you rely, just as you said, on making the speed of light a true constant that all observers will agree on, in fact, one of the only things they'll always agree on, then everything else comes down to arguments or disagreements over simultaneity. So I would say, when I disagree with Einstein's measurements on the train, say, I would say, well, Einstein, you got it wrong because you didn't measure the back and the front of your meter stick at the same time. And he would say, no, I did. It was simultaneous in my reference frame. You measured at different times.
Mm-hmm.
So he would say, for example, why would I measure his meter stick to have gotten shorter in the direction that he was traveling? He'd say, well, I watched you do these measurements, and I saw you measure the back of the meter stick, but then you took your time as the train kept moving the other direction, and then you measured the front of the meter stick. So Einstein would say, I messed up because I measured the back of the meter stick, let the train carry that stick some distance, then measured the front. So, of course, I got a shorter answer than his answer. And, of course, I would argue the same thing back to him. So he says it all comes down to disagreements over simultaneity, and that becomes a kind of linchpin to the rest of his arguments.
So it's all relative to where your frame of reference is.
That's right. And so certain quantities we'll disagree on. But other quantities, like the speed of light or other combinations of measurements that he found, will always agree on. There are invariants, even though certain parts of those quantities will be relative.
He was, speaking of relative, he was a relatively unknown person at this point, was he not?
He was. In fact, he was basically totally unknown in this period. You know, Einstein, it's easy when his face is always on the cover of Time magazine, even to this day and so on, to imagine that he's the most famous scientist of the century, whoever lived, or whatever. But that certainly wasn't the case when he was a young 26-year-old, basically low-end civil servant working in Bern, Switzerland, with a wife and a child and a lot of the kind of, you know, concerns of lots of other people. He was not a breed apart. He had went to university. He actually failed his first attempt to get into university, which might give some people heart. But he got in the second time. He did pretty well, but not across the board. He did great in math and physics and those subjects that had really caught his imagination. And he didn't bother extending himself to things like foreign languages or literature or other topics. He expected, he was very confident, he expected he would immediately be offered a university teaching job or some sort of assistantship in the university when he graduated, and he was continuously passed over. He thought maybe some of his university professors were sort of bad-mouthing him behind his back. That probably wasn't the case, but he got a little paranoid. And in the end, it was really the usual story of it's not what you know, but who you know. It was the father of one of his classmates who eventually sort of wrangled him this entry-level job at the patent office in the capital of Switzerland, in Bern.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones to Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to comment a little bit about one of the central facts of special relativity, that we all measure the speed of light the same in all of our reference frames. And that's because of that consequence that leads to the unintuitive result that we have to have different ticking clocks, that each observer has a clock that ticks slower relative to the other observer. But the fact that people think that seems so unintuitive, that the speed of light is the same in all reference frames, But the fact is that it really is intuitive when you consider that there isn't any air for the, you know, like sound moves in a medium of air, and if I had a loudspeaker that was moving, say, at a couple hundred miles an hour, and if for some reason there was a wind of a couple hundred miles an hour behind me, so that I would measure the speed of sound coming out of the speaker, and it was the same speed of sound that we'd normally knew, somebody who was stationary with me and the wind moving past him at a couple hundred miles an hour would actually measure the speed of sound to be a couple hundred miles an hour faster than we normally do. But it isn't so with light, because light just moves in a vacuum, and there isn't any way to really tell if there's a vacuum that's moving past you at high speed or not. So if you know, if light is emitted from, if somebody's on a spaceship that's going half the speed of light and they have a flashlight and they're beaming that light in front of them, and they measure that speed of light to be what we know, 299,000 kilometers per second, once it leaves that flashlight, there's no way for that light to know that it got this boost, this head start, for the person who's stationary to be measuring it. It's just light. It's a changing E field that makes a changing magnetic field, which makes another changing electric field. And the fact that it was launched from a flashlight that was moving fast can't affect its speed after it's been launched.
Okay, Robert, it sounds like you've thought a lot about this.
Yes.
Let me get a comment.
Well, yeah.
In fact, the whole question of an ether and what light moved through was one of the reasons Einstein discovered this about light.
That's right. So Robert's raising an excellent point. It's almost a little funny now that he says it's intuitive, or it could be intuitive if we think about it. And I agree. And he gave a very good explanation for it. But what's intuitive for us today was certainly not intuitive, you know, 100 years ago. And so, as you're mentioning, Ira, one of the key assumptions throughout all professional physicists in the era when Einstein was still a student was that this new exciting field of electrodynamics was really at root a study of this thing called the ether. In fact, its fancy name was the luminiferous ether, or the light-carrying ether. And that was seen both by the British experts in the topic, by the French, by the German experts, even though they might have differed on other details. They all agreed that the real game, the real name of the game, was to try to understand this mysterious substance, or sort of quasi-material thing, that they said had to fill all of the universe, every nook and cranny. Would be filled with this light-carrying ether. That was the only way that they could make sense at the time of how light waves actually could travel.
Again, if sound traveled through air, light had to vibrate something, which
exactly.
had to be the ether.
Yeah. Water waves, or waves right. of, you know, moving actual water molecules in the ocean, and so on. What was intuitive for them was that one had to understand the stresses or the strains, how one might sort of deform this kind of elastic ether substance, and that might change the local properties of electric quantities of how light would behave. And so that was what seems entirely intuitive 100 years ago.
Yeah. Let me just break in and remind everybody, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with David Kaiser of MIT. What is the central, I guess, I have spoken to, you know, people who knew Einstein, and they think that, you know, if you know nothing else about the special theory of relativity, it was that he made light a constant and everything goes from there. Would you agree with that?
I think that's fair to say. At least make the short list. You know, that's incredibly important. Yeah.
How long did it take for this to be accepted?
Yeah, that's a good question. And again, it might be surprising for some people, knowing what we know now about Einstein and about how central his ideas have become. This, you know, landed not quite like a lead balloon, but it kind of went nowhere for a long time. Einstein was actually very disappointed, as his private letters show. He expected this would set off great, you know, fireworks, and everyone would immediately come and want to meet him. And that really didn't happen. He got a trickle of correspondence here and there, a few passing mentions in the professional literature. And in fact, what mostly happened to really upset him was that people said, well, here's a really interesting little paper that does just exactly what other experts have been doing, like right. Lorentz or like right. Poincaré. And in fact, it was often called the Lorentz-Einstein theory of relativity for a while. So Einstein was sort of subsumed as the junior partner in the way it was understood at the time, even though they had worked totally independently. Mm-hmm. And it took really, you know, between 5 or maybe 10 years for Einstein's own vision of what he had done to become more widespread or accepted. And that was among the elite physicists for it to really trickle down. You know, we're talking about generations.
Right. Because, they, you know, he talked about time being changeable, so you had to have it come to an era where you could move things at very fast speeds, to, you know, in satellites, things like that, so you could test out whether time did slow down at high speeds.
That's right. And, you know, as your listeners will probably know, one of the consequences that Einstein quickly derived from this framework, which he submitted just in September of 1905, about 3 months later, was that E equals MC squared, which he saw as almost a minor footnote to his new framework for thinking about space, time, and motion.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, there were some experiments that were being done immediately that were seen as relevant to this derivation. Some experiments on, say, how would electrons move as they were accelerated to higher and higher speeds. Electrons are so small that people could, even back then, get them going pretty quickly compared to the speed of light.
But it didn't really lead to the atomic bomb. And people say Einstein's E equals MC squared led to the atomic bomb. That's not true, is it?
Well, again, I think it's giving a little more credit than maybe would be required. Certainly, the idea of E equals MC squared is important in understanding certain nuclear transformations. But whether that led single-handedly to the bomb, no. I think you're right that that's sort of an exaggeration.
Mm-hmm. So go out and celebrate Einstein. June 30th is the anniversary. When was the paper? He submitted the paper on the 30th. When was it published, actually?
Oh, that's a good question. Pretty quickly. It came out within 1905, so a few months later.
All right. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Well, thank you, Art. It's been my pleasure.
And happy anniversary.
Thanks. You too.
David Kaiser, Associate Professor of the History of Science and a lecturer in physics at MIT in Cambridge. Our program is produced by Annette Heiss, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is our director and our web producer, and our intern is Todd Neal. And if you missed any of the references we talked about, or you want to surf over to our website, you can go to sciencefriday.com, where you can leave us email, or you can send us mail the classic way, Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. And if you surf over to our website, you can also download Science Friday in numerous ways. We're now podcasting Science Friday, so we can podcast it, or you can listen on Real Audio, or take it on your Audible player. And also we have Science Friday's Kids Connection there. It's on hiatus for the summer, but there's still back editions of Kids Connection, teaching materials for Science Friday that you can use in classrooms, and you can just download them by clicking on the Teachers button. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.